Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great Christmas Eve show for you this evening, coming up with Frank Fascino on the Flatwoods Monster. Before that, we have Alejandro Rojas from OpenMinds.tv, and he's coming up to talk about the latest UFO events. Well, we have 1 week left for our contest where you can win a brand new iPad mini with no purchase necessary. And that's going to be drawn next week live on the New Year's Eve show. And here's quickly what you have to do to win. All you really have to do is go to podcastufo.com and all the information's right there. Now, listen, this is just for podcast UFO people. So you have a really good chance of winning. So sign up, please. Here's what you have to do to enter to win this brand new iPad mini or a fun swag bag. You go to Gemmer, which is GEMR.com. You register. You post as many items as you'd like, a collectible or something. And then you send an email with your username to contest@gemmer.com. That's contest@gemmer.com. And all you have to do is put your username in the subject line. And these will all be printed out, put in a basket. And I'm having a special assistant to come in on New Year's Eve and draw the winning names. So if you want to subscribe to hear the second hour of this podcast, go to getjoyride.com/podcastUFO. The link is right on our website. Subscribers pay only a dollar or more a month. And you can access the second part of the show, which is actually the full two-hour show, including a private link for iTunes. And this will work on other media players as well. And if you have any questions or problems or concerns, Get Joyride is being very good about this, helping people that have any type of problems at all. Just write me at martin@podcastufo.com. Now, I'd like to thank some of the subscribers. I'm going to give a little shout out. And these are for anyone that's donating $5 or more a month. I really, really appreciate it. I want to thank Phil first, our number one supporter. And Jason Burridge, he said I could use his full name. Sid R., Todd L., John S., Mark P., Chuck A., Donna K., Gary O., Bobby H., Robin, no last name or initial, Jeremy Z, Frank B, Mary Ann N, Jordan B, Jethro J, Randall S, Robin D, Bill E, Billy, Ed S, Alan S, Daniel M, Dan B, David M, and thank you all so very much. And if you'd like your full name announced, just send me an email and I'll announce your full name. So thank you all very much, and Merry Christmas to all of you, even if you don't celebrate. And I'm talking about everyone out there as well. And we're coming right up with Alejandro Rojas next with the news. How you doing, Alejandro?
I am doing very well. I just wrapped the last present I need to wrap, and I'm terrible at it. But I'm really excited. I'm headed out to Colorado in the morning, and it's time for Christmas. Let's do this.
Well, you know, I have to admit you're ahead of me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've yet to begun, but
oh my gosh!
But it's not Christmas.
You better get to work, buddy.
I know. Hey, I got something really exciting to tell you that has absolutely nothing to do with UFOs at all.
More exciting than Christmas?
Well, I'm pretty darn excited about it.
Ooh, yeah. All
right. I'm going to be one of the very few people that is going to be let in when Paul Revere's time capsule is opened. Now, if you're from another country, Paul Revere was a revolutionary figure that ran down the street, supposedly. There was a poem written about him. The British are coming, the British are coming. Anyway, he was also a very famous silversmith of the 18th century American, and he laid a cornerstone in the State House of Massachusetts of a time capsule, and that's going to be opened on January 6th, and I got invited, and there's not...
Wow.
There's only some media people that are getting invited, and I got invited through my antiques podcast, actually.
How cool.
So I'm excited. I'm going to see a part of American history opening right in front of my
eyes.
That's
really cool. I wonder, though, Do you have a lot of UK listeners? We get a lot of UK listeners, and I love them. But I wonder if you just offended them. If
they're I probably did.
Yeah. He's a British killer. We hate him.
Uh-oh. You know, yeah, they're like number three on my Google Analytics. So no offense. Yeah. You know, I'm sure.
What if there's a bunch of British hate stuff in there when you when they open the capsule? Uh-oh. What could be there? What might be there? What are historians thinking? Wow, if we find this, this is going to be really cool.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but they kind of already know.
Oh, really?
There was x-rays taken of
the box. This is getting less exciting.
It is. So why don't we end it right here? And I will talk about that on my other podcast, of course, which is...
Cool. Well, I'm happy for you, though.
Thank you. All right, enough of American Schmerican history stuff. What's going on with the UFO news this week?
UFO news. So we have a few stories that are sort of interesting. And most of these, I think, are, if not – well, they're all MUFON related, actually, interesting enough. The first one is a report from Ohio where these witnesses said they saw an alien running across the road. So kind of – crazy here. December 12th near Carmel, Ohio, this couple was driving. It was a Friday night. They turned up the road and they said something darted across the street that they described that they, you know, looking alien. The wife is the one who wrote about this. And she said her husband is a skeptic. He's a proud Marine. However, he did admit that he saw this. She had him draw it, and she posted the picture, and it's really weird. He said the thing was asphalt gray, about 7 feet tall, no arms but muscular legs, no jawline, and its legs were bent backwards, and it leaned forward as it ran. So some of the speculation online has been that it was a bird, but 7 feet tall is pretty tall, and I guess they get a lot of UFO sightings in the area, this witness had written. But yeah, that's kind of a weird one.
I'll say that's rather weird. And, you know, it almost sounds like it could be cryptoid. What makes them say right off the bat they think it's an alien? They didn't see a UFO or anything, did they?
Well, no, it just didn't have any arms and, you know, no jawline. It's very just so oddly shaped. That's why they say they think it's an alien, and or at least she does. She alludes to thinking it's an alien, and she does call it an alien at one point. But the news wrote about it as well because they had called the news, and they said that they wanted the local news. Actually, the local MUFON person called the news, and they wanted to kind of get the story out there to see if maybe someone had lost their giant crossbred ostrich or something, kind of looking for answers for this.
Well, if someone, you know, I mean, I like it when someone's like, they see something and then someone will say, you know, it's kind of like goes back to like this, well, you saw swamp gas, or, you know, you were seeing Venus or, you know, I mean, it's so
you're
far
right
away from what people are actually seeing. I mean, the description of what you're saying and both of them saw. It would be interesting to hear if this, whatever it is seen again in the area.
I agree. And maybe, you know, there'll be a time where they'll see some bird cross the road and they'll be like, oh, that's what we saw. It was just a bird. But it's hard to put, you know, not knowing these people, it's hard to say, oh, they saw a bird. Because, of course, if it was you or I, and we were saying we saw something strange, we'd probably be pretty upset if someone said, oh, no, that was a bird. Well, you weren't even there. How do you know? You know, so it's hard to say that it's definitely one thing or another with no picture or anything. So all we have is their word to go by.
Yeah. Yep. Something like Bill Nye would say.
Yeah. Bill Nye would say it was a sea monkey.
Sea monkey.
He said that before for UFO sightings, and I'm not sure what the logic was.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so what else is happening?
Yeah, the next one's kind of cool. This is in the Yucatan. There's a city there that is holding what's called an alerta. And it's in English, they call it a UFO alert. And what's interesting is they base this off of the MUFON stories that we write, that Roger Marsh writes and we post on our website, because he uses this UFO alert system to kind of say what states are having more UFO sightings than others, where it seems to be, you know, a lot of sightings going on in the area. And so I guess, according to this story in the Yucatan Times, people across the country have taken this term, UFO alerts, and they call it alertas, and they're doing these group night watches. And according to this story, they're really popular throughout the world, including Spain, where they get like 1,000 people to spend the night, you know, out watching for UFOs. So there's one scheduled for December 27th in the city of Ticul in the Mexican state of the Yucatan. That's what this story was about. And they're going to meet in an area called La Sierta at 8:30 p.m. And they're going to watch the sky until 4 a.m. And this was inspired by some sightings that they've had in the area. And in our story on this, I posted a couple of videos from sightings that we've written about in the area, including one that people think is squid-shaped craft kind of in the area. So that's kind of cool. It ought to be interesting. I mean, what if 1,000 people show up for this? That'd be pretty impressive.
Wow. Now, I wonder, like, what would happen if the next day the UFO decided to show up or something? I mean, yeah. They just plan on one night. You know, that's the infallible part about, you know, 1,000 people together, they may make a mountain out of a molehill if they see something like a meteor, you know.
You're right. And you know what I've noticed? This is my kind of putting on events. Of course, we put on the UFO Congress and everything, and we have sky watches there. If you have more than 5 or 6 people, it's not going to be a sky watch. It's going to be a social event. You know, people, we're just social, and we're going to end up talking amongst each other and discussing things and not paying attention to the sky and using our equipment as we should. So that's probably what it's going to be, a lot of like-minded people meeting as opposed to paying attention to the sky. Maybe there will be some who do. But, yeah, you're right. I don't know if this is the best tactic. Really, it's more about quantity. It's more about getting out there and looking at the sky as much as you can.
Right. And, you know, there may be some serious squid watchers there.
Yeah.
You never know. And, you know, that thing that crossed the road, hey, a squid, maybe?
Well, it only had 2 legs that were muscular. It's important, if you're going to investigate this stuff, Martin, to pay attention to the details.
Okay.
2 legs that were very muscular as opposed to 2 dangling tentacles.
Well,
and
yeah.
It had multiple dangling tentacles.
Okay. I guess there is a little bit of a difference. So. All right. So we have another story, do we?
We do have one more last story. This one was from yesterday, and this is kind of cool. This is a sighting in Pikes Peak, near Pikes Peak, which is outside of Colorado Springs. And they said they saw a horseshoe-shaped object. And they did take pictures, and you see it looks like it's about dusk. And there is a bright light over the mountains here in Colorado Springs. And so it is very anomalous. This person said they saw it hovering or moving very slowly. Then it hovered, and then it disappeared. And it was a cloudy night, so you know that it wasn't just a star or a planet. So kind of an interesting sighting here. Some people have noted that there's a lot of military in the area. And there is. There is Fort Carson. There's Peterson Air Force Base. There's the Air Force Academy. There is actually NORAD and Cheyenne Mountains right there, and there is the home of Space Command is right there and right along this mountain range that they're talking about. So could this have been some sort of Air Force or military drone or something possible? But the picture is very vivid. You can see this brightly lit object above the mountains, and so it's kind of a neat report here.
And that'll be on your website, which you can find through the show notes. Now, you said it's a horseshoe shape. That's a little different than a triangle.
Well, it's hard to make out. You don't see a horseshoe shape in the – you just see a bright object. But that was what the witness described was a horseshoe shape.
Interesting. Now, you're coming back next week, And we're going to talk about the year-end cap of all the events that happened. This should be a great show next week. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I've been compiling the stories of the year, and I'm shocked at how many great stories and great sightings there were for the year. So that's going to be fun.
Well, if you stay tuned just after the music, we'll be coming back with Frank Fischino. And hey, Alejandro, have a safe trip to Colorado and a wonderful Christmas.
Thank you. You too. Have a Merry Christmas.
Have a holy. Let's sing together.
Okay, ready? 3, 2, 1.
Have a holy, jolly Christmas.
Oh, we suck together.
It's the best time of the year.
I don't know the rest of the words.
Holy
Christmas.
This year.
Ho, ho, the mistletoe.
I don't know that we could do any better.
I know. Alrighty. Greetings, Frank.
How you doing, guys?
Hey, how you doing, Frank?
Good, very good.
Merry Christmas, and thanks for coming on the show. And this show is being touted as the Flatwoods Monster Christmas Eve show, and it's all over the place. If you Google that on the internet, you'll see. How did you get that to happen?
Well, I contacted Alfred Lemberg at a UFO magazine, and we had a little chat, and before you know it, Alfred wrote this cool article, and he put it up, and it connected, and it's just kind of snowballed from there.
No pun intended, snowballed.
Yeah.
Hey, if you're listening live, please jump over to the chat room at podcastufo.com. It's a real quick sign-in, and you can join in. And it's kind of a low attendance in there tonight. A lot of the regulars aren't there. Matter of fact, there's only a few people on. But if you'd like to jump in the chat room, you're welcome to ask Frank some questions as we go along here. Frank, before we get started in any of the Flatwoods Monster Braxton County case, or don't shoot him down, the military or Air Force shooting down UFOs, any of that stuff, let's hear about yourself. What got you interested in the topic, and what was your first pursuit of any of these UFO topics? Was it the Braxton County incident? And just go ahead and fill us in.
Well, I have some family that actually lives in Braxton County, and right in that particular area is where everything happened up there back in September 1252. And I just kind of stumbled on it by accident, to tell you the truth. I didn't know much about UFOs, and what happened is I started talking to the locals at first up in the mountains up in Frametown. And my cousin had property back in the early 90s up there. And I would start talking to some of these people, and they were telling me UFO stories, and not many of these stories reached out of the mountains. Then I started looking into the crop circles that were appearing throughout Braxton County, and a primary chunk of them had actually appeared on my cousin's property. I contacted Colin Andrews, and I met with him in 1991. I gave him all of my data, photographs, soil samples, and I was looking into the crop circle stuff at first, just because I happened to be up there. And to make a long story short, a couple visits later, going up there to visit my cousin, I found out about the Flatwoods Monster case. Somebody said, oh, this stuff has been going on for years up here. This is nothing new. You ever heard of the Flatwoods Monster? And I said, no idea what you're talking about. So I actually drove with my cousin, and we went into Flatwoods. He took me into the town, and upon reaching the town where the limit sign is, it says, welcome to Flatwoods, home of the Green Monster, which I thought was kind of crazy back then. I'm like, wow, maybe something really did happen here. I don't know. Well, I started talking to some of the locals, and at first it was like trying to pull teeth to get people to talk. And as I got a few years into the case, I understood 100% what had actually happened. when this incident occurred on September 12, 1952, it hit the worldwide press pretty far-reaching, and it was a big story. And shortly thereafter, the witnesses were made fools out of, and the whole thing was turned into a joke. And all of these years later, it basically was a folklore tale until I started digging further into it. And as I started getting into the Project Blue Book documents, what happened there is it took me about 5 years to go through the documents and decipher them, because there was a process when they were Xeroxed on the old machines back in the day. By the time the copies were photographed and put onto microfilm, they had faded. So I had to work for several years with different people trying to figure out what everything said in these documents. And when I finally figured all of that out, I started showing the witnesses up there what had actually occurred that night. And the Flatwoods incident was actually towards the end of a UFO flap that had occurred that night. And I started documenting all the locations throughout the United States where there were sightings. And as far as I know, and from talking to Stanton Friedman, it's the biggest flap in the United States history of UFO sightings within a 24-hour period.
Right, yeah.
So it was basically, I kind of stumbled upon this thing, and it intrigued me. And but you know what was interesting, Martin, is at the very beginning when I first started talking to the people, what I found more interesting was the expressions on the people's faces and their attitude when I would mention the Flatwoods Monster. It's the Braxton County Monster, same thing. You know, they were kind of scared about it. And they didn't talk about it. They would turn their backs on me. In some cases, the door was slammed in my face. I was told to go home in so many words. We don't fool with this story up here no more, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, something happened up here for these people to have the attitude of that, and they were so cautious about everything. Well, they were made idiots out of for so many years. They had backed down, basically told the public to back off. They didn't do any interviews, you know, a couple of anniversary stories here and there. But the story was investigated on the onset by Ivan T. Sanderson and Gray Barker, and they had a lot of valuable information back then. And then I went into another gear, and I started looking at newspaper articles around the United States. And that's when I realized how many different UFO sightings there were besides just the Flatwoods incident.
Hmm. Now, when you were investigating this, and the people started like loosening up, what did you do that made them feel comfortable?
Basically, I was honest with them. To tell you the truth, I was honest with these people, and I had to prove myself to them. You know, this didn't happen overnight. This took certain witnesses, it took a little bit longer. But when I pulled out the Project Blue Book documents and laid them all out in front of the May family, Kathleen May and her two boys were, they were the primary witnesses in this case. And then I showed Ailey Stewart Jr., who was the reporter, Johnny on the Spot, who broke this story to the world press. I showed him the documentation, and that's when they really opened up, because they were unaware of what was going on behind the scenes. You have to remember, back in 1952, Project Blue Book was still closed. It was classified at that point. So none of the original investigators nor the witnesses knew what was going on behind the scenes. And there were so many sightings around the United States that day. You know, you have to put yourself in the mindset of 1952. A lot of people didn't even know what was going on, you know, in the next state.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
There were the peripheral sightings all around West Virginia and up and down the East Coast, as far out west as California, too. And I was able to contact libraries throughout the United States. What happened, it was like the breadcrumb trail. I started picking up on patterns and putting them together as I started working with maps. If you go to my website, flatwoodsmonster.com, you could see updated photographs of my master map. And there's several articles online that show this detailed map that's the size of a wall, And what I did is I would just pinpoint all these locations, and then finally I was able to figure out the flight path trajectories and what had occurred that night. And it was just connecting the dots. That took several years. Uh-huh. And what happened is I started doing more radio shows like this. The general public would hear my shows, and they were contacting me. And they were giving me more sightings and more locations, which would fill in the gaps in between and strengthen the flight paths. So we had a lot that was going on. There was about 21 hours of sustained sightings on September 12, 52.
Now, getting back to the ridicule part of this, do you think, and I would probably guess that that would have to do with the Robertson panel, with their decision to make sure that UFO sightings and people were ridiculed?
Oh, yeah, that's a big part of it. And what I found out as well with the Flatwoods case is that intelligence was in on a covert operation and undercover and went in there to see what was going on. And then the next thing, the press, what was released into the press was ludicrous, you know, the explanations, and they just made fools out of the people. The Air Force definitely had to tamp this story down and squash it because it was so big and far-reaching. They actually went in there undercover. And to go a step further, I found the commander from the West Virginia National Guard, Colonel Dale Levitt. He was a captain in 1952. He was served in World War II. And Colonel Levitt is the one that got the call from Washington to go to the crash site with his troops. Well, I met Levitt a couple times. He was kind of closed-mouthed during the first time I spoke to him. He wouldn't let me interview him to be taped. He wouldn't allow any taping whatsoever. But as we loosened up a little bit, he started telling me a little bit more about the Flatwoods case and his involvement, and it was a lot deeper than I had ever imagined. What was written in the history books up to that point was basically Levitt and his troops were in Flatwoods and surrounding areas for crowd control. Well, I found out he was actually up on the farm with about 50 to 60 troops. He went up there, cordoned off the area, and took pieces of what was on the farm, crash pieces, bits and pieces of this, soil samples, leaf samples, everything in that area where it happened on the Bailey Fisher farm. And Levitt basically, in our interview, which was about 45 minutes long, he told me the details of how everything worked.
How about
and
that?
As far as I know, that's the only taped interview of Colonel Levitt in existence.
Really?
And I have a little documentary I put together. It's on YouTube. If you just type in Book by Fischino, F-E-S-C-H-I-N-O, it's about a 45-minute documentary, and I have highlights of the different key players that were involved in this, including Levitt.
Oh, yes.
It's pretty cool because you can actually see it. Besides, the book has everything in full-blown detail, but it gives you a feel for what actually happened back then.
Uh-huh. If you're listening live, we're on with Frank Fischino and the Flatwoods Monster, and you can jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com and pose a question or talk to other people in there. Frank, it just occurred to me that there may be a number of people listening or that will be listening to the podcast later that have absolutely no idea what we're talking about. Can you describe in a nutshell or go right into detail this whole case from the beginning in September of 1952 and the witnesses, what they saw, and then the variations that happened later? Just go right ahead and give it all to us.
Okay, well, let me jump into this first, Martin, because this is a key foundation for the story. Back in 1952, it was a record year for UFO reports mm-hmm. that were sent to Project Blue Book. And Project Blue Book was in charge with the investigation and evaluation of the UFO reports at the Air Technical Intelligence Center. And that was from 51 to 69. So that year had 1,501 reports. 303 were unknown, so that was the banner year for UFO sightings. What's more interesting is when you analyze the summer of 52, the banner months for that year. June, July, August, and September had 1,134 reports, and 111 were unknowns. So that is like the key part of history for the influx of the rise during the summer of 52. What was going on? The Flatwoods Monster incident happened at the tail end of the summer on September 12, 52. And that year, you know, you go back a few weeks earlier, we had July 19th and 20th and 26th and 27th weekends where the UFOs flew over Washington and Virginia, mm-hmm. and jets were sent out and scrambled against them. And there was actually another weekend, a lot of people aren't aware of this, where on August 5th, 1952, there were also jets in the air over the Capitol area. So we had three consecutive weekends. Then the key part that has been overlooked in UFO history is we jump up to July 28th, and there were shoot-them-down orders that were revealed by the United States Air Force. The press person who took care of that was Monsell Montz. Mm-hmm. And he talked about shooting the flying saucers down if you couldn't talk them down. So there was a lot going on. And from that point, you jump up about 6 weeks. You have several damaged crafts that were flying into the United States airspace and crashing throughout the country. What I did is I pinpointed every single location where these crafts actually went down. And I put together the whole big picture of what happened for that night. That's why it took upwards of 20 years. I'm about 22 years into the case now. But that's why it took so long to figure out, because there was so much going around the country. It was hard to figure out what actually occurred. But to shoot them down portion of what was going on is a big key to that whole thing.
Right. Right. So why don't we go right into the incident itself on September 12th?
On September 12th, 1952, there was a bunch of kids. This is the basic story that's been written up in the books for over 60 years. There was a bunch of kids on the Flatwoods Elementary School playground, and they saw this gigantic craft that was shaped basically like an egg. And they saw this craft flying over a mountaintop towards the playground where they were. Now, a key part of the whole story, Martin, is Flatwoods is the geographical center of the state of West Virginia. It's dead smack right in the middle. This is where the playground was, okay? If you go 206 miles to the east, that's where Washington, D.C. is, and we'll get into this later because this plays a big part in it. But these boys saw this craft coming towards them. It made a 45-degree angle turn, went to the back to the east. It was from the north heading south, turned, went east, and it flew up on the top of a mountaintop, and it dropped down and settled down to the top portion of the Bailey Fisher Farm. At that point, some of the kids didn't know what it was. Some of the smaller kids says, well, maybe it's a meteor. Some of the kids said, oh, it's a UFO, it's this and that. All these kids were in a commotion. They started screaming, yelling, jumping around, and they all took off to go see what this thing was. They ran up to the nearby home of Kathleen May. Now, Kathleen May, two of the boys within this group were actually her kids, Freddie and Eddie. And at that point, the kids go busting into the house, and they're screaming. Something landed up on the hill on the back mountain. And they all gathered together, and they eventually took off to go see what happened. This was just about dusk. The sun was starting to settle at this point. Well, Mrs. May, she was 32 years old at the time. And there were seven other boys, okay? So we have eight key players. And these eight witnesses were the ones that were reported by the press who were involved in the incident, who saw the monster. Some of the kids took off and went home. and they were scared to go up there. It was starting to get dark, and they chickened out, and they left. I actually met a couple of them up there a few years ago. And what happened is they took off to go into the back area where this thing touched down. And along the way, there was, I'm going to bring a little bit more details into this, there were actually three dogs that accompanied the group of eight witnesses. The first one was a collie. It was a big dog, and it was from one of the neighbors, one of the nearby neighbors in the area of Mrs. May's home. This dog heard all the commotion. It came outside, and it ran up to all the kids with Kathleen. There was two other dogs. One of them was Gene Lemon's dog. He was the 18-year-old who was a West Virginia National Guard member. That was Mrs. May's cousin, so he was the oldest boy. Then there was Freddie May's dog, okay? So we have these three dogs in the pack, all the people, and they're heading to go up to the back. Now, a key part of this, Martin, is I have to give the layout so the listener understands the geography of the farm. The Bailey Fisher farm is basically broken into three parts. When Mrs. May got to the end of the road, which was a dirt road back then, that is where the Bailey Fisher farm began. It was a big, wide, open area. Just beyond that was a fence and a gully area that sloped down to the right. And in this gully area, there was a bunch of trees. There were pear trees, okay? You keep going up towards the back of the hill or mountain. This is where the craft touched down. It was a gigantic field sitting up on the top of this plateau that overlooked the whole property. So we have the first field, the second field with the gully, and the back field. The witnesses, the kids on the school playground, they saw this thing stop in midair above the above the plateau, and it dropped. This is where they were going. As they started going onto the property of the Fisher farm, the farm path cuts to the left and goes to the outside perimeter. They walked across this portion of the pasture, and then they got to an area where there was this big fence, and it was to keep cattle and horses out, okay? And this fence was a metal fence. When they got to the fence, they opened it up. They unwired. They walked onto the property. Now they are onto what is called the wagon path. This is where they brought the animals back and forth off the property. The property starts to make an incline. They close the gate behind them, and they start walking up this hill. The dog collie took off like a bat out of hell and ran straight up the hill. There was something going up on there. It went to investigate. As the group started going up the hill, they smelled this terrible stench that smelled like rotten eggs and sulfur, and something was burning. Off in the distance, a couple of the witnesses were looking out to see where this thing touched down, and they didn't see it up on the back plateau. What it had actually done is once it touched down, it moved, and it tucked itself in the corner to the right behind the trees by these pear trees. And it was pulsing intermittently, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. The craft had actually moved and relocated. They're moving up the hill, and it bends around to the left, and it starts to straighten out a little bit. And right at that point there's another fence. And it was a fence about 3 to 4 foot high, and it had two posts, one on either end of the path, and it had big slats that were nailed from post to post. The dog, the collie had moved ahead, went over this fence, or in between it, we don't know, because it took off, and it started barking, it let up a racket, and it yelped, and it turned around, and it headed back down the path. At that point, the first few of the group had reached this wooden fence. and the stench started rolling down, and they started coughing and gagging. They started feeling the effects a little bit, and it was this horrendous smell, and it wasn't a normal fog that was settling in the area because it was coming down the path towards them. At that point, Lemon's dog was approaching up there with Freddy's dog. The first dog is gone, and Mrs. May, Gene Lemon, Neil Nunley, Eddie May, and Ronald Shaver, witnesses I had interviewed the majority of them, they had passed over this gate, and they're moving up a little bit closer. At that point, Freddie May, Teddy Neal, and Tommy Heyer, he was a little boy that was in the group. He was the youngest. He was 6 years old. They stayed behind and just had reached the fence with the two dogs, hadn't passed over it. And Freddie told me in an interview, he just started climbing over the fence, and he looked straight up in front of him, and he saw the group moving towards the left-hand side. What had happened is Mrs. May and Gene Lemon saw something that was glowing up to the left portion of the path. Now, the left side of this path, about 4 feet set up off this little ridge, is the woods. And there was an oak tree there that was approximately a little over 100, 125 foot tall by an estimate. It was sitting there, and there was something next to it. And next to this tree, it looked like two eyes were glowing. Mrs. May and Lemon thought they were an animal perched up. The eyes were about 12 feet up in the air. And they had their flashlights with them because they were expecting to go way out to the back. And if it got dark in the meantime, they would have their flashlights to get back down to the house. Well, Mrs. May and Lemon, who were leading the path, saw these lights up 12 feet in the air, and it was along the perimeter of the woods. So it was a little bit darker back there. They aimed their flashlights simultaneously and clicked them onto these big eyes, and it wasn't a possum or it wasn't an owl in the tree. It was this 12-foot-tall mechanical creature, Martin. And this thing had a big Ace of Spades covering over its head, and it had a glass shield barrier in front, and it was basically shaped like the lower portion of a rocket. It flared out on the bottom. This thing lifted up and hovered about a foot in the air. That is what it was actually an exhaust that was making them sick. It was that sulfur smell. This thing came down this slope from behind the tree and moved in front of Kathleen May, and Gene Lemon was so startled it scared the heck out of him. He fell over. Momentary lapse, bang, he hit the ground. Mrs. May was looking at this thing, and it was squirting some type of an oily substance out, and it was shooting, and it hit her in the face, covered the front of her dress, and it hit some of the oil hit some of the nearby kids that were there. Well, this thing was making like a hissing noise. It was mechanical. It was actually a hovercraft. The lower portion of it had pipes that went around the circumference. Freddie May, when I interviewed him on site and videotaped him, he said the bottom of this craft was approximately 4 foot across, and then it tapered towards the shoulders, and it was basically cylindrical. He, during another interview, he held his arm out in front of me, and he said those pipes were about as thick as his arm. And he said they were about as thick as a fireman's hose. And this is where the exhaust was coming out. This is what made him sick. The head area was described to me as being round, and it was had like a red face. And Freddie May likened this to a helmet inside of this cowl, okay, that was like Ace of Spades shape, where it had a glass covering in front. And he said it looked similar to a pilot sitting in a cockpit of a jet. Do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He's looking into this thing. There were not eyes. That was a discrepancy. You know, the press made a big joke out of it. They said it had big bulging eyes and blah, blah, blah. Mrs. May said they were actually portholes, And one of the famous quotes of Mrs. May is, the thing lit up like a Christmas tree when she hit it with the flashlight beam. And I've interviewed Mrs. May several times over the years and different witnesses. The portholes lit up from the inside, and it didn't shoot out like laser beams of light. What it actually was is, this thing was a mechanical device, and Mrs. May and Lemon, when the beams hit it, this thing reacted. And I was very adamant talking with Mrs. May about, you know, the reaction between her and Lemon and this thing when the light hit it. And that's when she said it lit up like a Christmas tree. And the light from the inside of this mechanical device actually forced through the portholes. And Freddie May told me he believed this thing was being controlled by something inside. It was like a small shuttlecraft. And what was great about working with the May family so close is Mrs. May told me she was about the length of a car away from this thing. So this thing almost was on top of her. She was that close to it. They hadn't seen it right away. They just saw these two things that looked like eyes 12 foot up in the air. And she said that, she told me it hovered about a foot to a foot and a half off the ground. And as it passed in front of her, she got a really good look of this thing. So she gave me a lot of really good details that I was able to do thumbnail sketches, and I'm an illustrator trained at Pear College of Art. Freddie May saw the whole thing unfold back at the other gate. So he was giving me the details and the layout of the kids and where everybody was situated. So I have an up-and-close personal witness. Then I have another witness back here. The couple other witnesses I interviewed, plus getting all the old notes and all the old documentation from Sanderson and Barker and everybody who investigated, I took all of this and I compiled it together. Okay, so what happened is Lemon fell over. He got back up. Mrs. May turned around after this thing was basically coming towards her. It was coming from the left to the right. This thing hovered and went back into the pasture of the second farm and headed back towards where the thing, the craft, was sitting back up by the trees. Mrs. May and the group ran back down towards the house, and it was just pandemonium. Mrs. May told me that she leaped over that wooden gate, which was 3 to 4 foot high in one bound. And she says, and I passed several of the kids on the way back to the house. And it was approximately about a half a mile run. And what happened is, subsequent investigation by Ailey Stewart, who went up there, he told me, I went and I stayed at his house in North Carolina when he was alive for a few days, and we went over this and over this, and I videotaped them, and we drew maps and pictures. And what he said is, when he saw what the witnesses and other people called skid marks, there was a pair of skid marks. They actually weren't skid marks. What they were is, they were trails. They were parallel to each other, and they had moved from the area of the craft. So between the craft and the tree were these big scarred marks, and what that was from was the propulsion system of this small spacesuit craft. When it touched down after it relocated, it moved through the pasture. Now Stewart and the other witnesses told me at the time, the grass, the majority of the grass in that area was about knee to waist high. So you have something that's about 4 foot wide that's the equivalent of, say, like a leaf blower walking through the field with a 4 foot wide leaf blower. And it moved up to the tree. When it departed, it followed the same parallel path. So you have one track going up to the tree and one away back to the craft. And that's what everybody referred to as the skid marks. Stewart told me that there were several rocks and small stones that were flipped and turned over within the area of that path. He said, so there was a lot of force and a lot of power to lift this thing up and move it. And there was oil strewn throughout that whole area where this thing was some type of a machine and it was leaking. So the folklore and the myth of the monster, of it was a 12-foot tall figure wearing a dress with arms and claws. They were, the arms and claws were actually some type of antenna device that came off of the shoulders, between the neck area and the shoulders. Freddie said the shoulder area was about 4 foot wide. And then it flared out like a booster rocket to about 4 foot. When the witnesses got back to the home, they called up the authorities. The sheriff was running around Braxton County like a chicken with his head cut off because they were getting calls and receiving calls of objects and other objects crashing around Braxton County. So there was a lot of pandemonium going on that night. Ailey Stewart Jr., who was the co-owner with his dad of the Braxton Democrat, which was located in the county seat in Sutton, right next door, he got a call, and the state police were not in the area. They were out running around as well as the local authorities. They were getting these calls of things flying over West Virginia and crashing. So nobody knew what the heck was going on that night. When Stewart went up to the home of Mrs. May, he sat down and he listened to what May and all the kids were talking about, and he got a couple of the boys to take him back up to the area. And so he was actually the first person of authority because he was given this to go cover the story. The reason he went up there is because he was a photojournalist and he had a camera. He was a reporter. He was trained military as well. And he went up there to represent the police because they couldn't make it. What he would do back in the day, he told me, he would go to the different crime scenes and he would photograph the crime scenes when they would put the chalk around the bodies or the accidents, whatever he was involved with. So he was pretty tight with the police. That's why a reporter was sent up there as a rep. So he was up there on the farm for a little while, and he told me that what they had done is they basically put together a posse. They were all armed. They had shotguns, they had rifles, and they had handguns. And the kids were so scared, they knew something had happened up there. By the time they got up there, this Flatwoods monster had actually went back into its craft and departed, and it landed about 17 miles away in the town of Frametown.
Wow, this thing just keeps going on and on. And, you know, I have a number of questions. We have about 6 minutes left to the top of the hour. But the thing that comes to mind right off the bat, did anyone, you know, people were getting, some of these kids were getting sick from this gas. That whole incident sounds so primitive to me. You know, it sounds like a very primitive mechanical, like, drone or craft or whatever it is, spewing out oil and noxious gas just to scoot around. Maybe if it's extraterrestrial, comes from a different planet with no gravity, didn't, you know, or low gravity. And you know, who knows? You could speculate all kinds of things. But did anyone test the oil, like, for instance, on the apron or the oil on the ground or were there any tests done of that?
Colonel Levitt told me that he picked up, and this is in detail in the book, and he talks a little bit about it in the interview. He picked up the oil. He said the oil was puddled by the tree because where that thing was sitting, it was some type of a constant leak, and it puddled. He was told by the Air Force to gather everything up. He gathered all this oil up. He had put it in jars, containers. They told him to get soil samples from the immediate vicinity. They tried to pick everything up as much as possible. He was up there with his troops. They cordoned off the farm. So it was covert. They came in through the back portion of the Bailey Fisher farm property. So the locals up there and Mrs. May and the whole group didn't even know they were there because they came in on the backside. And he gathered all of this stuff up. and he told me he shipped it back to Washington. Ailey Stewart told me that he found a piece of metal in the track the following day. He went back up there at sunrise, and it was confiscated from him. Hmm. He had some people come into his house, and they said they were from the Treasury Department. They asked him for a piece of it, and later on when he went back to his home, the rest of it was gone. And this was right before, like the day before he was going to go on national television with a piece of the metal that he had found in the craft.
The Treasury Department.
Yeah, that's what he told me. They were from the Treasury Department. They were investigating this, and they wanted to look at this piece of metal that he found. He told me that his dad wasn't too happy that he was shooting his mouth off, basically telling everybody in town that he had this.
Hmm.
And the next thing, well, the place was infiltrated by intelligence. So, you know, you don't even know who you were standing or talking next to. People were just coming in and out of there. It was estimated, Martin, in about the first 4 to 6 weeks, there was about 10,000 people that went to Flatwoods. If you drive through Flatwoods and blink, you're out of it. So to have that many people, I mean, it hit really big. It hit the press right around the world. There were people driving from all over the United States as far as California. They knew about this thing in Europe. They found out about it in Japan through the Stars and Stripes newspaper. It was a really big story. And when Mrs. May, Lemon, and Stewart went on national television, the story hit even bigger. And then there was another influx of more people coming in, and reporters, magazine writers. You know, it just got crazy. Radio shows picked up on it. So it was pretty far-reaching. As far as everything else, everything was basically cleaned up.
Hmm.
And there is some information about different people. And this is written in some of the articles that I found in the archives, that the locals were going up there and they were finding pieces of stuff that was strewn around the farm. There was a good-sized farm, and the activity happened over this one particular area. So the people were going up there and they're finding this stuff laying all over the farm. So they were picking it up and sticking in their pocket and going home. So God only knows how much stuff is laying around Flatwoods in shoeboxes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, you don't know.
Did Mrs. May hang on to her oil-doused clothing?
Okay, what happened was actually during the first interview with her. I asked her the same question. I said, Kathleen, I says, what happened to your uniform? She said two guys came to her home, and they said they were reporters at first. And she kind of blew them off. And to make a long story short, it turned out they weren't reporters. They were intelligence officers. And they went to her home and they asked her for the uniform. I said, did they take it? Where is it? She says, no, they didn't take it. They took a little special tool and they scraped all the oil out of it and packaged it and gave me my dress back. And I'm like, you're kidding. They really did? And she said, yes, they did. They scraped it out with a tool, packaged it, and that was it. I says, what'd you ever do with that dress?
Yeah.
You know, and she said, Frank, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
At that point, it was like over 50 years. She said that dress was long gone. And then I remember her in another interview, her saying, I couldn't have done anything with it anyways. You know, here it is. It's got all of these scrapes, these little stains and stuff on it, and everything was taken out of it. So this thing was covered pretty well. You know, the Air Force had a lot of experience in covering everything up, and, you know, God only knows how many intelligence officers were really there. And I used some of the research from Major Kehoe, who had investigated the case through his Pentagon sources. And I kind of linked everything together between Sanderson, Gray Barker, the other people who had investigated in the whole story. I have some new interviews in there from new newspaper reportings, you know, new old. And then I have everything from Keo. So what I did is I put together a timeline of everything that happened in that 24 hours that was available to me. And I kind of linked the whole story together and put the dots together. There was a lot going on up in Flatwoods for 4 to 6 weeks right after.
I bet. Well, what are we going to talk about in the second hour, right at the top of the hour now?
What I think we'll get into a little bit is what happened after the Flatwoods Monster left the farm.
That sounds
good to
me.
Because the story doesn't end there. It keeps going, and it gets even better.
Okay. So, if you're listening live, we're going to just take a quick little music break. So hang in there. And that's it for our show today. So remember, you can listen to the second hour of the show by becoming a subscriber for as low as $1 a month. And that's at Get Joyride. Once again, don't forget to enter the iPad Mini Contest. It's no purchase necessary. It's free at Gemmer.com. You register, post an item, and that's all you need to do with that to actually win, and that's coming up in 1 week. And let me just tell you this. You have a very good chance of it. Not a lot of people have entered, and there's also swag bags going out on that as well. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Alejandro Rojas for the news. Of course, our guest, Frank Fascino. Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. Now, remember, come back next week live. It's not going to be a live show. I'm sorry. It's going to be a pre-recorded show, but we are drawing live the winners of the contest. And that's right here. We're going to have a recap of last year with Alejandro Rojas. Second half is going to be just a rehash of the guests we had on 2014. And thanks so much, and Merry Christmas, everyone.